If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome to an all-new episode of Fatal Fandom. This week, we're diving into the nearly fatal attack on Teresa Saldana. And with that, let's dive right into today's episode. March 15th, 1982, late morning sun warmed North Harper Avenue in West Hollywood. Quiet pocket where people watered plants, sorted mail, and rehearsed lines behind thin apartment walls. Teresa Saldana stepped into that light with an easy purpose born from momentum. At 27, she had weathered the long odds of Hollywood and began to be recognized for the fierceness and warmth she brought to the screen, in Raging Bull and Defiance. She planned ordinary errands before an afternoon meeting. She waved to a neighbor, carried a handbag, and a small list. Across the street, a man left the shade and moved towards her. He wore a brown coat that had seen better days, shoes that eked out one more mile, and an expression that never quite aligned with the scene around him. In his pocket was a 10-inch butcher knife wrapped in paper. His name was Arthur Richard Jackson, a Scottish drifter whose journal said God in the movies spoke to him. He had crossed an ocean because he believed Teresa had too spoken to him. Through a film, through a look, through Faith's private frequency. "Are you Teresa Saldana?" he asked, voice gently and careful. She nodded with a polite half-smile, that small kindness actors offer strangers. The blade flashed, a first strike to her side, a second to her shoulder, a third, a fourth, a fifth. The blows piling with a mechanical rhythm that replaced thought. Screams ricocheted off the stucco. A woman on a balcony shouted. A phone slammed onto a cradle and dialed again. A water delivery driver named Jeff sprinted from his truck, tackled the attacker, and pinned him while others kicked the knife away. "Please don't let me die," Teresa whispered as the sirens rounded the corner. 10 wounds marked her chest, back, and abdomen. Both lungs were punctured. Her liver was damaged. Her heart had nearly been reached. She was 27 years old and still breathing. The attack lasted less than 2 minutes. Its origin stretched across decades. Arthur Richard Jackson's first known address is not a street as much as a condition, the chill of Glasgow in 1936. A city where smoke and work stitched the hours together and where a father's departure could turn a boy into a watcher. His mother raised him through spells of fragile health and frayed nerves. This episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest, most reliable way to stay safe online. Let's be honest, the internet isn't exactly a safe neighborhood anymore. Between hackers, data leaks, and companies tracking everything you do online, protecting yourself is no longer an option. That's why I use NordVPN. NordVPN keeps your data encrypted and your identity private with next-generation security. So whether you're on public Wi-Fi, traveling, or working from home, your information stays yours. Think of it as your own digital security guard, always on duty. And with over 6,000 servers in 60-plus countries, you can connect anywhere in the world with a single click. Want to stream shows from another country or access websites that are blocked in your region? Easy. NordVPN makes it happen instantly. I use it personally when I'm researching true crime cases and need to access archived or international sources. Keeps my work secure and my connection private. So here's the deal. Use the link in the description today. And at checkout, get a huge discount on a 2-year plan plus 3 extra months free. That's 77% off a 2-year plan with 3 extra free months. It's an incredible offer for complete digital protection. Don't wait until your data ends up in the wrong hands. Stay safe, stay private, and stay secure with NordVPN. Because your digital life deserves protection. Now, let's get back to our episode. He learned early that the world could be both loud and inattentive. A place where a child's questions dissolved before they reached adult ears. Teachers called him bright, odd, detached. He preferred books to games, churches to pubs, radio sermons to conversation. He copied passages from the Bible and Victorian hymnals in cheap notebooks and then filled the margins with arguments addressed to no one living. He spoke in full paragraphs, as if everything were a testimony. As a young man, he drifted through menial work, messenger, porter, clerk. Co-workers remember a courtesy that never connected and a stare that lasted two beats too long. He took loneliness as evidence of chosenness. Coincidences became messages. A shuffled hymn on the radio became an instruction. A stranger's glance became a sign. The notebooks thickened into a wall of script where fate, angels, and women on screens formed a private liturgy. By the late 60s, he had made a narrow life in a London bedsit, a mattress, a kettle, a radio, and stacks of journals. Psychiatrists brushed against him briefly after a trespass at a church and wrote down words like eccentric and harmless. No sustained treatment followed. He wrote, he walked, he watched. He sent letters to actresses that were unthreatening in grammar and unbearable in assumption. He told himself the universe had paired him with a woman of light and that only distance prevented their union. In 1980, he sat in a dark theater and watched Raging Bull. Teresa Saldana's scenes registered not as performance, but as visitation. Her steadiness, her eyes, the way she held a room without demanding it, he recorded all of it as proof. "She has recognized me," he wrote. "The veil is thin. I'm to rescue her from unreality." Obsession is a carpenter. It measures cuts, sands, and fits. Through 1981, Jackson built a structure around the idea that Teresa was speaking to him. He watched every appearance he could find and annotated them like scripture. A smile meant permission, a pause meant urgency, silence meant the world was conspiring to keep lovers apart. He began rehearsing his own role. He drafted letters he never sent, refining his cadence, deciding which biblical citations sounded persuasive. He learned the names of agents and managers and assistants. He practiced a baritone he thought sounded like authority. He experimented with aliases until one felt smooth in his mouth. The plan that emerged was simple and devastating. First, credibility, a call to a Los Angeles private investigator as Alan Smith, a European casting agent seeking Teresa for a prestigious role. Second, proximity. The investigator shared professional contacts that led Jackson to a phone number in New Jersey. Third, intimacy. Posing as Martin Scorsese's assistant, he told Teresa's mother there was an urgent production matter and asked for an address. She offered it, thinking she was helping her daughter step forward, not ushering danger closer. In February 1982, he sold what little he owned and bought a one-way ticket to Los Angeles. In a small suitcase, he packed shirts, notebooks, and a kitchen knife wrapped in newspaper. Flight attendants remembered a quiet, polite passenger who stared out the window as if reading something written on the clouds. He was not going to meet a person. He was going to meet a destiny he had rehearsed until it hardened. Los Angeles in winter looked like a promise that never expired. Billboards floated above sun-bleached streets, palms carved the sky into vertical lines, and studio gates turned fantasies into payroll. For Jackson, it was revelation you could walk through. He checked into a motel off Sunset where the ice machine rattled like hail and the carpet held 1,000 anonymous stories. He mapped Teresa's neighborhood and routines the way a pilgrim maps holy sites. He sat in a cafe with a view of her block and timed the morning departures, afternoon returns, and sweeping trucks. He followed at a distance to a market and then back, careful to believe he was not stalking but stewarding a divine appointment. He bought the butcher knife at a hardware store, told the clerk it was for cooking, and then wrote in his journal that the instrument had been chosen. Witnesses saw him and forgot him, which is how danger often works. A neighbor thought he looked like a visiting uncle. A passerby thought he was a tourist. He rehearsed greetings aloud and evaluated their resonance. "Are you Teresa Saldana? Do you know me?" "I have been sent." He chose the first for its plainness. By March 15th, he had resolved that delay with disobedience. He put on the brown coat, pocketed the paper-wrapped knife, and walked towards a narrow street whose street scraped at chain link, and a young actress reached for her car door. Proximity is its own violence. Jackson closed the last steps with the quiet of a man obeying orders only he could hear. "Are you Teresa Saldana?" he asked. She nodded. The first blow folded her sideways. Confusion brightened her face before pain took the frame. The second staggered her. The third drove her down. He muttered about freeing her as the blade rose and fell, a metronome of delusion. Sound changed shape. A scream became a siren. A siren became promise. An upstairs neighbor threw a potted plant that cracked against the pavement. A car horn leaned on its own shock. The delivery driver, Jeff Fenn, ran with the clean purpose of a decision already made. Launched himself at the attacker and drove him to the concrete. The knife skittered. Hands appeared with towels, with courage, with a trembling insistence that she stay. "Please don't let me die," Teresa said, and strangers told her she would not. Paramedics loaded her into an ambulance that smelled like antiseptic and speed. At Cedars-Sinai, surgeons opened, repaired, drained, and sutured, while a clock on the wall pretended time was ordinary. 10 wounds, 2 collapsed lungs, a liver stitched, a heart spared by inches. Outside, reporters gathered phrases. Inside, a life held on. At the station, Jackson was calm. He explained that he had freed her from an illusion, that now the world would know their bond. He quoted scripture and journaled between questions. He asked whether the light in the room could be dimmed. He wanted to rest. He thought the hard part was over. Survival is a profession. It sets hours, assigns tasks, and evaluates progress with a severity no boss would dare. In the months after the attack, Teresa learned to breathe past the ache, to stand without the room tilting, to trust stitches to hold. The hospital corridors smelled of bleach and hope. Nurses spoke softly and with authority. Doctors called her recovery improbable, and then possible, and then remarkable. The body is not the only patient. Night gathered its toll as images replayed without consent. A shadow by the door rehearsed the blade's arc. A knock condensed into the syllable of a question. Panic rose when a tray clattered. She kept going. Physical therapy unstitched stiffness. Friends read to her and made jokes they were afraid to tell. Letters arrived by the hundreds, some tender, some invasive, a few from stranger whose words echoed the very delusion that had nearly killed her. When she went home, the ordinary world felt full of ambushes. The aisle where knives hung in a store, the alley that narrowed behind a theater, the rearview mirror's sudden face. She learned new rituals, checking locks, scanning thresholds, setting limits. She refused, however, to disappear. "If I go quiet," she said, "then this script becomes the story." So she wrote her own. In 1984, she portrayed herself in a television film, Victims for Victims, the Teresa Saldana story. An act of reclamation that turned a crime scene into a set where she called cut. She founded Victims for Victims to make sure the next voice shook less alone on a witness stand. She spoke at police academy where recruits learned the name stalking as a prelude rather than a nuisance. She testified where policy is minted from pain and insisted that the law learn the language of obsession before the knife arrives. Courtrooms pretend to be laboratories, but they are theaters first. In 1983, jurors watched exhibits of phone logs, airline stubs, and a 10-inch blade. They heard the investigator describe the credible accent on the phone. They heard her mother describe a call she wished she had never taken. They heard psychiatrists explain delusion as a country with its own borders and traffic laws. The defense argued that Jackson's map of reality was so altered that intention could not be measured by ordinary measurements. The prosecution argued that planning survives madness, that lies on the phone and purchases at a counter reveal knowledge that something was wrong and a will to do it anyway. Jackson sat mostly still, taking notes, smiling faintly when Teresa's name appeared in the air. After less than 2 days, the jury convicted him of attempted murder and assault with a deadly weapon. The sentence ran to 12 years, served largely in a locked hospital where doors shriek and time pools. Upon release in 1994, he was deported to Britain, threatened another woman, and was confined indefinitely in a high-security psychiatric institution. He died in 2004, unpersuaded by any world that did not include a covenant only he believed in. To call Jackson evil is to stop the inquiry too soon. To call them only ill is to mistake a danger for a diagnosis. The record speaks of entomania braided with paranoid schizophrenia, a system of belief in which a public figure appears to declare secret love and cosmic purpose. The media's false intimacy, faces large as walls, voices carried into kitchens, gave his delusion props and sound design. Loneliness gave it fuel, neglect gave it time. Forensic notes mention how his writings reframed violence as purification and the knife as an instrument rather than a weapon. That vocabulary matters. It is how a person performs moral anesthesia on himself. He did not wake one morning wicked. He rehearsed a story in which harm became rescue and refusal became conspiracy. The story hardened each time. No one interrupted it with treatment, containment, or consequence. The case forced police departments to learn new habits, to log fixated contacts, to link threats across jurisdictions, to involve clinicians early, to teach public figures not only how to wave, but how to warn. It also forced the entertainment industry to admit that accessibility is a beautiful risk. Fan mail and stage doors were not quaint. They were vectors. Teresa returned to set with scars that camera crews learned to fight or light with gentleness. On the commish, she played Rachel with the gravity of someone who understands the quiet after a siren. Between call sheets, she answered letters from survivors and connected them with advocates who had learned to sit beside grief without rearranging the furniture. She was honored by victims' rights groups and by officers who had taken her trainings and then recognized danger sooner on a call where a woman said a stranger would not stop appearing. California's first anti-stalking statute arrived in 1990, sharpened by the gathering of cases that began for many, with Teresa's name, and culminated in the murder of Rebecca Schaefer. The legal vocabulary changed. Credible threat, course of conduct, restraining order with teeth. Prosecutors learned to braid incidents into a rope that could hold in court. Judges learned that an empty promise is not safety. Teresa never romanticized recovery. She described good days like clean windows and bad days like weather moving in. She insisted that people say the words victim and survivor without flinching, because both were true and neither finished the sentence. When she died in 2016, obituaries listed roles in advocacy, but the most accurate record lives in quieter places. A woman who slept through the night because a detective had been trained. A college student who recognized the pattern early and left. A family that opened mail without flinching because a stalker had been stopped. Fame is a microphone that also amplifies echoes. It invites devotion and projection in the same envelope. The attack on Teresa made plain how screens manufacture a nearness that is not a relationship and how a mind like Jackson's can mistake a performance for a covenant. It also proved that stories can fight back. A woman refused to be reduced to an episode and instead authored a curriculum that travels farther than syndication. Arthur Jackson's name belongs to the ledger of preventable tragedies and to the syllabus of forensic psychiatry. Teresa's name belongs to policy, to practice, and to the stubborn optimism that telling the truth precisely and repeatedly can edge risk backward. She once said survival was not just not dying, it was finding the use of what tried to end you. She found it in classrooms, hearing rooms, squad rooms, and living rooms where someone finally believed the sentence. I feel unsafe. The morning on North Harper Avenue remains fixed in photographs and testimony, but the aftermath is mobile. It lives wherever vigilance is practiced as care rather than paranoia. Wherever treatment arrives before headlines, wherever a passerby decides that running towards a scream is not someone else's job. The story is grim. The meaning is generous. It says that 2 minutes can shatter a life, and the years can build one again. Sturdier, with windows that let in light and locks that answer to wisdom. Now, let me know your thoughts on this story in the comment section below. And if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, you can find us on all major podcast platforms, including Good Pods, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts from. And with that, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.